I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
All right, welcome everybody to the Fried Egg Podcast. I'm Garrett Morrison, and today is a bit of a departure from our usual subject matter. We're talking about golf equipment, specifically used golf equipment. I've wanted to do an episode on this subject for a while now, in part because it's pretty hard to get a hold of new golf clubs these days. Obviously, the supply chain debacle has affected every industry, and the golf equipment business has not been spared. So I thought it would be interesting and potentially useful to you to talk about how to build a bag of really cool, affordable, used clubs. And I figured that in talking about that, we would end up exploring the history of these clubs, what they represented, and overall how the equipment industry has changed in recent years. So basically, when it comes down to it, bread and butter, fried egg stuff. And I have no doubt that the best person to do this experiment with is Ryan Barath. Ryan works for Tour Experience Golf, or TXG, which has a popular YouTube channel you might be familiar with. And he's an absolute encyclopedia of golf equipment, especially when you're talking about stuff from the past 25 years or so. He knows everything. So let's get to it. Let's talk equipment. Let's talk used clubs. Here is Ryan Barath.
So for me, I was a kid that always took things apart, basically. I was one of those kids. I was lucky. Toaster breaks down, my dad let me rip it apart. Lawnmower breaks down, my dad would let me rip it apart. Never had to put it back together, thank goodness. But for me, it was always being able to kind of get inside of my hobbies. So if I rode a bike or rode a skateboard, I always took those things apart as well. And when it came to golf, the exact same thing happened. And I immediately got hooked on golf equipment, watching the PGA Tour, watching television. Not so much seeing commercials, because I know this, I kind of joke, it always dates me, but like pre-internet, there was golf magazines and club building magazines, and I would get these catalogs and I would just comb through them over and over and over again. And for me, that was kind of the stepping point into equipment. And being a kid, I got my first kind of like knockoff set of golf clubs, and then I always really wanted, you know, for me, an aspirational club at the time was like a Ping I 3, because I guess that would have been like late 90s, right around 2000. But I didn't realize, because again, the internet really didn't exist. You couldn't find all this information, that the i2 was not the precursor to the i3. There was all these irons in between. And because I couldn't, as a 14, 15 year old, could not afford a brand new set of i3s, I bought i2s. And then I kind of learned as I went on all these different elements of like fitting and lie angle. And because when I got them, they actually didn't fit me very well. Didn't know that at the time. And someone helped me with that. And from then I was hooked. As soon as I realized you could change golf equipment to help it make you play better instantly with something like that, I was completely hooked into the industry. And then from there.
So this was before you had a job in the equipment industry. When you were a kid, you were just kind of tinkering with clubs to make them fit you better.
Always tinkering. Like, it was just something I was always trying to figure out a way. And I mean, I was a decent player. I started off as like a high handicap, like everybody else. And then after a few years, I got down to probably like the mid single digits. And then it was like, I was trying to search for every edge, because a lot of the kids I was playing with were better than me. So like anyone, I think any gearhead, any start of the gearhead that kind of gets into golf is like, okay, I've kind of figured it out to a certain point. How can I make my equipment better for me? And then when I went to school, that was when the actual job came into play, because I started working at a big box retailer.
So a few years ago, you were working for Golf WRX, writing articles. Now you're with TXG. Your title is Lead Content Strategist, I believe.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about TXG and tell me about what you're doing there right now.
Yeah. So TXG, we are a custom fitting studio, so a bespoke club fitting studio. And the big thing for us, and a lot of people might be familiar with our YouTube channel, Theon, is that it's all about sharing information. It's about educating people. And, you know, for me at TXG, again, we are there to help people find the best equipment for their bag. And, you know, the best way to describe it is we are a custom tuner shop for golf clubs. So people come in, it's a one-on-one experience, and they get to work with one fitter kind of through the entire process, from putter to driver, using the basically the highest level of technology, including Foresight and Quintic and all these high-speed camera pieces of equipment, to help you get dialed in, whether you're, you know, trying to play on tour or you're trying to break 90. We're here to help everybody play their best golf by making sure their equipment fits them absolutely to the best as possible. Kind of like, you know, you go get fit for a suit, we're going to make sure everything is just tuned for you.
So we are recording this on an interesting day for TXG. There is now a partnership between TXG and Club Champion, but my understanding is that the YouTube channel is going to continue to produce content, and so fans of that are going to continue to get a lot of the same type of content.
Our goal and our strategy is not changing whatsoever. When it comes to our club fitting, we're completely brand agnostic. If you come in and you want a specific brand, we'll help you find something to get into that. But if you come in and, you know, you end up with a pink set of irons and Titleist Fairweights and a TaylorMade driver and some Callaway wedges, like, that's the goal. And none of that is changing. You know, Club Champion, is obviously a large retail chain in the United States. Gone through a lot of expansion. And for us, we're in Toronto. A lot of people are very familiar with our social media presence and our YouTube presence. But, you know, we are two locations and we do have a full built shop, a full manufacturing facility. It's not enormous, but we have a fairly large space that we build golf clubs in for people and send golf clubs essentially all over North America and the world. So we've always wanted to continue to grow, and this partnership helps us with that.
All right. So what we're going to be talking about today is sort of to the side of what TXG's club fitting business is really about. You know, TXG fits people into new products. We're going to be talking about a much cheaper way to engage with golf equipment, looking for used clubs and kind of getting into the history of these clubs and hunting for deals and things like that. So that's where we're eventually going with this. But before we get into building a specific bag, I thought it would be a good idea to talk about some general trends in the equipment industry, where you see things going, zeroing in specifically on when you kind of started working in the equipment industry. This was in the early 2000s, mid-2000s?
Yeah, roughly around, I would say 2004, 2005. And that would have been when I started in the, like, kind of the big box space. And I joke with people now that it was like the golden age of technology. I know, obviously, Fried Egg, we always talk about, or not we, sorry, you guys talk about the golden age of architecture, right? Like the way things kind of were at a certain time. And I joke with people of my own age, being 35 now, that for me growing up, like, that was the golden age of like technology advancements. Like, I remember the first 400cc driver, the first 460cc driver, the first adjustable driver. Nowadays, like, direct-to-consumer brands offer adjustable drivers. They're everywhere. It's something you can just readily get. It's not even a second thought at this point that you can go in and find something that's going to be adjustable with your driver and your fairway woods and all of those different, even hybrids at this point. But back then, that was a massive leap. And I can remember all of those different elements coming into play, and people would come in and it was just like, this is insane. Like, how does this work?
That's why I'm particularly interested in talking about the early 2000s. So like 2000 to 2005, we're going to kind of focus on that period quite a bit in this episode, not exclusively, but we're going to talk about that period specifically. Think about what happened in that era, you know, that basically the advent of the 460cc titanium driver happened in that period. There were big drivers before that, but that's when it really became common and mainstream for drivers to be that size and to be made out of that material. The popularization of the hybrid, that was happening at around that time. The introduction of the solid core urethane cover ball. So the Pro V1, the Pro V1X was 2003. The Tour Accuracy, Nike Tour Accuracy was before that, like 1999. And so what's happening in this period is really interesting in the sense that it kind of set the stage for what's happening now, right? What's happening now is in many ways just an elaboration of what was going on in that period. And, you know, also from a general perspective, what you saw in that era was much faster product cycles, right? Because if you think about the 975D driver from Titleist, That was introduced in 1998. And it stayed on the shelves for a while.
Yeah, it just hung around. Like that was probably the biggest change that I saw in the industry. And, you know, I think companies have really started to change that method. You know, we saw around 2007, 2008, when they realized that, okay, maybe we shouldn't try and sell 3-4 different drivers a year and try and come up with a new product quarterly or whatever. Because at that point, right, there was less advancement, but people were like, okay, well, I'm starting to kind of realize that maybe fitting is probably the better option than just trying to buy something new every time. And
and to put a finer point on it, in the 80s and 90s, companies would keep a certain product on the shelf as their iron or their driver for a long period of time. In some cases, for years, right? The Ping I2 irons. My understanding is that was Ping's like sort of lead iron for more than a decade, maybe?
It was. The Ping I2 lasted for more than a decade as their premium product. Now, it did go through some different iterations. Like, you can see different patent numbers and sole grind. So, there was the I2. So, as the golf ball advanced, they started offering stronger lofts. So, that anything you see a plus is the I2 with different grooves and different shapes. Like, they did always tune them, but that was it. It was like, you know, there wasn't the consumer demand for new all the time. And, you know, we see that now with phones and computers and anything that's technology driven. There's this greater desire to have something that's new. And, you know, that's consumer driven, that's company driven, that's OEM driven. Do I need a new computer? No, but I want a new computer because it's got a nicer camera and it's got a keyboard that does something different. And there's that element of golfers that want stuff. And then there's the golfers that, you know, I just want to go out. I want to have fun with my friends. And I'm not really too concerned about equipment. And those people coexist fantastically in the golf industry.
And then it sounds like from something you said earlier, that maybe around 2007, 2008, companies actually backed off that a little bit, that it got to a point where new models were coming out so quickly that there started to be a problem with kind of oversaturating the market. And since then, we've seen a little bit of a pullback there.
Yeah, the industry was driven by people buying off of, I want it now, going into a store and immediately walking out with a set of golf clubs. Again, talking about those times when I was working in the big box retail, I won't name the company, but you know, we would get a couple times a year a pallet, like, you know, it seemed like Costco at the time, a pallet of golf clubs. So we're talking 60, 70 sets of irons, half regular flex, half stiff flex steel, standard grips, kind of basically just in a box. And they'd be maybe a couple of years old. They'd show up on middle of the week, receiver would get them. You'd put them right at the front lead of the aisle. They'd be in a flyer and people would walk in and go, oh, where's the $4.99 set of irons? And you'd point down and they go, thanks. And they'd grab the box and they'd walk out. There was no fitting. There was none of that stuff, because that was just the way people perceive buying golf equipment. It's like, I am stiff steel. I'm regular steel. Let's get out of here and let's go play some golf. But even I think all of the OEMs driven by Ping from kind of basically when they started, thanks to Karsten, is fitting. And you see that now. So if you walk into a big box store, you probably see a lot more clothing now than you do floor space for golf equipment, because they're not carrying the inventory because they want you to get fit. And in that time period, as the cycle was increasing, you could, I mean, not to blame the guy, I mean, he revolutionized the industry, but Sean Toulon, who was working for TaylorMade at the time, basically said, we're not going to come up with one driver, we're going to come up with three drivers. The 300 series, which was the 300, 320, and 360. And at the time, 360 was, again, a massive looking golf club. And they said, that's going to be a flop. Like, that big one, no one's going to want it. And what happened? It was the number one selling driver by a massive margin because it was more forgiving. And people immediately went, why do I want the 300cc one? This is ridiculous. This is like my old driver. I want the big one. I want the quote-unquote toaster on the stick, because people would swallow their pride if they hit the drive 250 yards. You know, it's always the benchmark number for a lot of people. And that set a revolution off for every OEM, most, not every, but a lot of OEMs, where it's like, wow, like if we are, and it was a custom fitting story as well, because, you know, you want workability, you want forgiveness. And that set off the industry of, you know, we got to give people, if they want options, we can give them options. And producing overseas and all those things kind of led to that perfect storm, I think, of what was 2008.
So what do you think are some of the biggest things that have changed between, say, 2008, since we just mentioned that year, and now in the equipment industry?
The two biggest things would be, adjustable hosels and adjustable weighting in drivers. And we see it now too with, again, we are at a point where most companies are releasing, say, 2 to 3 drivers to fit different customers. But I think it's much better in the sense of the way they're doing it, because it used to be, you know, you'd have one driver and it'd come in 3 different loft options. So a store would have to carry all those. Now you have something where you have a draw bias driver, more of a player's driver, and like a super forgiveness driver. For most companies, you'll see like a 2 to 3 model options for most OEMs. And then from there, you have adjustability, you have adjustable weight. And all of a sudden you're dialing people in to these products a lot better. And I think those are the biggest things, is the adjustability element. And then at this point now, it's the manufacturing side of things. The ability to cast extremely thin, forge and weld and get into these products. There's very little, almost zero wasted mass inside of a club head to create mass properties. Whereas if you ever cut open an old driver, like a Warbird or something like that, there's a lot of stuff going on in there that, you know, is just there because it has to be, because that's just what happened.
It's more of a solid hunk of metal, those clubs.
Very much so. I've talked to people that worked at Callaway kind of during that time, and like, you know, how difficult it was to, you know, because those drivers, when they came out, were also very expensive. The Great Big Bertha was considered an enormous driver at the time.
Yeah, was it 250 cc?
I think it was around 250 cc's, and that was the biggest Big Bertha. That was the biggest one you could possibly buy.
I remember when the Great Big Bertha came out, because I was about 11, and I was really into golf at the time. That driver looked huge, and it was very expensive. There was no way I was going to be able to buy it.
Hugely expensive, yeah. And that was like me with the Ping ISI, like Tech. That was the next one that came after the ISI. It was huge. I knew somebody at the golf course where I played had one, and it sounded loud. And I was like, $700? I'm a 50-year-old kid. That's like, yeah. And what's that, 3 years worth of salary? I don't know.
Like, yeah,
there was no parallel line for me to that. And so that's how I got into gear, because I wanted to figure out the best way possible, and taking things apart was just kind of part of it. And the other thing too, which I should have mentioned, as far as technology is concerned, launch monitors. We see them on the PGA Tour. That is literally the biggest advancement. Other than equipment, if you didn't have a launch monitor, you didn't understand the data, you're just looking at ball flight, like the ability to tune equipment now is thanks to that stuff. You know, that's really probably the best answer when it comes to equipment, is launch monitors and then everything else.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, what do you have when you're getting a fitting? It's all based on the launch monitor and the information that's coming out of that. And then it's up to the fitter to use the adjustability of these new clubs to find the right combination for the individual player. And I should mention that I find all of this fascinating, but I also find it somewhat disturbing because the equipment has gotten so good. In many ways, there's not a way to put the genie back in the bottle. And I am concerned for golf courses.
I always say that I ride a very fine line. I ride a tightrope with this, because I do see both parts of it. You know, part of me wants to see the best players in the world play events with persimmon and half sets. And we see it with the Wishbone event that they hold. I think Link Soul holds it at Goat Hill Park, where they have the pros and they play with persimmons and things like that's so cool, because like, you know, if they miss it a little bit, you hear someone like Jeff Ogilvy talk about, no, if you neck one, it goes 220. Like, that's just the nature of like what happens when you use that equipment. And I have bags of persimmon equipment. I love playing with old equipment. But I also understand and know that when I see golfers come into a fitting and they're hitting their driver 200 yards or 220 yards, and they all of a sudden they hit it 245 yards, that is hugely helpful and beneficial to them with new equipment. Just say 25, 30, maybe 40 years ago at this point, you walk into a store, the only clubs you're going to get were blades. Like, that was it. And whether you were a beginner golfer or a pro, like, you're using blades. And now pros use blades, some low handicap amateurs use blades. But the amount of technology that's in golf clubs to help people enjoy the game, I think is massively beneficial to the biggest part of the bell curve when it comes to golfers. What we're seeing is this technology that when it comes to the professional level and the high level, like we saw at Kapalua recently, scoring records broken, not once, not twice, but 3 times in one day, basically at the end of the event, that there's something up. And I know the golf course can be soft, and you know, people will joke that the greatest advancement in golf courses is the lawnmower because of consistency and roll and all those different things, but they're hitting it so freaking far. And part of that is because the technique has changed with the equipment. You can't swing like you can with a persimmon driver. I know because I've tried. You can't hit 3 degrees up and 3 degrees out to try and smash this draw at swinging full out, because if you hit it half an inch off center, it's going to go 180 yards and duck hook. Whereas if you do it with a modern driver, you're just on the left side of the fairway.
There's a lot that I agree with there. I think the place where we might disagree or just have a slightly different point of emphasis is when we talk about fun and the modern average golfer. Because, you know, you and I both remember the before times, so to speak. Yeah. Right? The times before the Pro V1, before the titanium 460cc driver. I remember that people had a lot of fun playing golf in the 90s. And it was players of all abilities who had fun. I'm not sure I see evidence that those same players are having more fun now. Do you think equipment advances since the mid-2000s, or even before that, I guess, maybe we should put the mark at like 1999. Do you think the equipment advances since then have made the game more fun for the average player?
I think they make it more. Yes, I do. I do believe it. Like, and again, my default, because I'm close to this person all the time, is my dad. My dad started playing when I started getting it. He always played, but he never played as much as when I got into playing golf, because it was like a thing that he could do with me. And so we would go out and play, or he'd drop me off and go play or whatever. And before then, he never like played in a golf league. He never did any of those things. And I can remember helping him get fit, like really get fit for a set of golf clubs. And, you know, he doesn't practice really that much. His back or elbow can bug him once in a while. And all of a sudden, it's like, I don't have to work as hard to, not that he would always shoot like X score all the time, but like, just because if I miss hit a shot, it wouldn't hurt as much. That's a big element. Where, you know, if you hand someone just swinging a really heavy golf club that has a stiff shaft and hits it off the toe of a blade, that's going to sting a lot. So I think that side of it is where like the fun element can make it easier for people versus the always focusing on the score, because it is the experience of playing. And in many cases, if you can hit a golf club that doesn't hurt to hit, then that can be a big proponent of like a big component of being able to have fun just being out there with your friends.
Not being in pain.
Not being in pain, literally not being in pain, having soft grips on golf clubs, all of those things where, no, they weren't always an option, can be the fun element of just being out there and enjoying the game as a whole. And I think equipment helps with that, but I don't think for depending on your level or depending on how you want to enjoy the game, you can go out and play with persimmon and blades. And I know a bunch of sickos that like to do that, just like myself. And, you know, I remember your podcast with the Hickory Open, Those are the serious sickos there.
Right.
And their way of enjoying the game is to have it like exist in a certain era for them or whatever people want to play it. And, you know, if it means doing that and, you know, having a stinging shot once in a while, that's okay. But for a lot of people, it just means going out with their friends and making some shots a little bit easier.
Yeah. Fun, as always, is a very complicated topic in golf and quite subjective. Obviously, the discussion of whether there should be new club regulations and whether they should apply to only pros or apply across the board to everybody in golf deserves its own podcast. We don't need to keep going down that rabbit hole right now. I'd like to start to push us toward building a bag of used clubs. But just to kind of clarify one part of why we're doing this, right now, people are having some trouble getting a hold of new clubs.
So I'll keep names out of it when it comes to companies, but there are companies that are struggling with getting product to the point where there are almost unknown lead times, which is pretty insane, because of manufacturing, because of logistics, like ports, all of these different things, even materials. That makes it difficult for us and for everybody in the industry. I get emails and messages all the time of like, you know, how long would this take if I get it, or how long are those kind of things? Certain clubs, like you're get, like they'll be here in June, and that's just the nature of the beast across the board. And you know that applies to, you know, I drive by car dealerships every day, and there's a car dealership in my couple of car dealerships. They have 4 cars on the lot, used to having not maybe close to 100, and it's because of material shortages, whether it be like a single part or something like that. And we've seen it with grips and shafts and club heads across the board. Everyone's doing their best. Some companies have started express flying product over, which becomes more expensive. It's all part of a cost that adds up. So we see these equipment costs rise because people want them sooner. And just like because of those things, you know, it is becoming more expensive and it's just across the board difficult.
And you know, so one thing I believe is that the best way to get the best equipment for your game, if you're looking at finding that edge, if you're really interested in having the best tools possible at your disposal, getting fit for new equipment is obviously the way to go, but it is an expense. And so I was interested in looking at another way of engaging with equipment. There's a different way to do that, and you don't have to spend a whole lot of money doing it. And that's kind of looking at the used club market. And by the way, these days, when you buy a used club on eBay or on one of the used club outlets online, it'll arrive pretty quickly. There's no particular delay for used clubs. They're already there. They're going to get sent to you. And so that's maybe part of the appeal right now of this particular hobby. What are some of your tips for hunting for cool used clubs? What are some kind of general techniques that people can use if they're doing this?
Yeah, my quick list would be looking at the ferrules, which is like the little plastic part between the head and the shaft. If they all match on a set of golf clubs, it means that they were probably never reshafted. If something was broken at some point, one of those might mismatch, which is always an easy thing to spot. And then asking for length. A lot of times, I mean, I've literally made the mistake of going into a used club store, buying a set. They were like bundled up. They were a good deal. I walked out and I got home and I was like, these things are an inch over length. I didn't even check. Like, what an, like, just stupid mistake to make. So those little things where you can just ask those small questions. If you can, ask for the lie angle of the golf club. Some cases, most forged golf clubs and some cast golf clubs can be bent fairly easily and almost at no cost. If you're buying them from a lot of stores, they'll do it for you. That's not a huge issue. And then grip condition is the other one. You know, if you want to go through the expense of getting new grips, you can. A lot of times you can wash them and they do freshen up quite quickly. But it's looking at the little things where it comes to like larger rock dings when it comes to irons or wedges. You can see those really quickly. But it's the ferrule. It's any bends in a steel shaft. If you can see it, most sellers will let you know if there is any issues. Most of the time there's not. And then grip condition as well. So those are the big kind of like really quick things to look for. And if you have them in person and you're not sure, just ask about the lie angle, because that is something that is crucial. Even if it's if it's way off, you're going to be in big trouble. At least if it's like close, you're going to just enjoy it so much better.
Before Ryan and I get into building our bags, I'd like to say a quick word about Fried Egg events. Our first three events opened for registration on January 3rd, and all of those are currently sold out, but a new batch of events will become available for signups on February 7th. That's Monday, February 7th. One of those events will be The Banker at Dornoch Hills Country Club. Dornoch Hills is a pretty special place. It was Perry Maxwell's first design. In fact, he built it on his property. And it was sort of his laboratory for architecture ideas before he went on to design Prairie Dunes, Southern Hills, and the other great courses that are on his resume. Just last year, Dornoch Hills was restored by Tom Doak and his team, and it looks incredible. So that's the venue for The Banker, which will take place on June 6th and will open for registration on February 7th on thefriedegg.com. All right, back to the episode. So each of us researched two bags. Bag one is what you might call an optimal set of used clubs for a total of less than $750. That was the number that we kind of set ourselves, right? We got to stay under this price for the full set of clubs. Bag two is a set of used clubs from before 2005. So clubs that were released before 2005. And we set a price of $400 for this total set of clubs. Each bag has a driver, a fairway wood, a hybrid, a set of irons, two or three specialty wedges, and a putter. We used eBay as a reference point for prices just to make things easy while avoiding sketchy sellers on eBay who are pretty easy to spot. I mean, yeah. if the shipping charge is $100, then don't deal with that seller. But we basically looked at eBay for these prices. Clubs in decent condition. This is one thing that I kind of, you know, yeah, you can get some clubs for really, really cheap. But if there are sky marks on the fairway wood, I don't really want it. you know, I don't necessarily want junk. And so I'm looking for things that are in like fairly nice condition, you know, 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10, somewhere around there. We're choosing clubs that were just, that are just suited to our games. Right. And you mentioned earlier, you're like a mid single digit handicap. You've gained some speed lately. you've been doing some speed training. So you're a pretty strong player. I'm a very average player, you know, somewhere around a 10 handicap, very average swing speed, 100 miles per hour or so. And so we're not going to speculate about what an average golfer wants because everybody's different. And so we figured might as well just find stuff that would suit us. All right. So why don't we get started? Let's dive in. Let's start with the driver. So for the sub $750 set, what I picked, and I'll explain this in a second, is the Srixon Z785 from just a couple of years ago, 2018. So I was looking at the $750 budget and thinking, where do I want to spend my money? And I thought, I want to spend it on driver and wedges, getting some nice clean wedges and getting a driver that's fairly up to date. And this driver is $200 right now on the used market. And so that's where I think I'd go. Where were you at for your driver on this?
Yeah, so for myself, you know, being the club nerd, this is kind of a game that I used to play all the time just because I could, because that's what happens. I actually had two options, but I will go with the Titleist 910. So a little bit older. For my set, I wanted two fairywoods. So I stretched the budget on the driver a little bit. But in most cases with the Titleist 910 driver, it offers adjustability. It has a couple different models. So there's the D2 and the D3. So you can, D3 is a little lower spinning, a little smaller D2. But I found a Titleist 910 D3 with a stock shaft, which the Titleist ones have in that era had some really good options.
Great stock shafts, yeah. That's the big appeal of the Titleist woods, by the way.
So they're not like the same aftermarket, but I actually worked for Titleist during this era for a season. So I'm quite familiar with the product, and I love this driver. I always thought it was a really good driver, and because it offers adjustability, that to me was my go-to for the driver was the 910 D3.
All right, going to pre-2005 for driver. My choice was the Ping G2. And this has I think it's pronounced Aldila.
Yep.
Aldila stock shaft, which is a good stock shaft. It's $55. This is a 460cc driver, so it almost feels like cheating for this category to choose this one because it is effectively a modern driver. I know this one would be pretty effective. So what did you go with for pre-2005?
G2 is a freaking great driver. I had one of those things. I loved it. I actually went with, because I was, again, I was trying to work with two fairy woods and I like irons. Irons is always like a big, like I kind of nerd on irons a lot. So I went with the Cleveland Launcher 400. So 400 cc's, still pretty big. The 400 came out around, and the Cleveland Launcher comp came out just after that time. And actually those still go for a lot of money. But I got this driver for like $45. With, again, a lot of I think it had a Vista Pro, like a Fujikura shaft in it. Really good driver. I had a friend who had one of these. He used one of these things for almost a decade. So another driver I'm very familiar with that's well under the $50 price range.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other pre-2005 candidates I was looking at, there's the Cleveland Launcher series, and it got up to 460 eventually, but those were great drivers. The Titleist 983K, which is definitely smaller than 460, because I believe the first 460 Titleist driver was maybe 2005 itself with the 905R. Is that right?
You got it. Yeah, there was the 905 S&T, which came before. They were both 400cc drivers. And then the R kind of snuck up there, and all of a sudden they released the 460 version of it.
And that's a super usable driver now, too, the 905R. Yeah,
that's a classic. That was the one Adam Scott used for a very, very long time with a ProForce V2. I think Adam Scott sold a lot of ProForce V2 shafts back in the day, thanks to that driver.
This is an interesting era for drivers because they were changing so quickly and really racing toward their modern profile when you look at them down by the ball. When you see a 905R, it looks maybe a little more sleek than most of the drivers you see today. Of course, this is 905R is not within our date range because it is 2005 instead of pre, but you look at it and you think like that's basically a modern driver. But if you went 5 years before that, the drivers would look a lot smaller to the modern eye. Most of the ones that were coming out from OEMs at the time.
Hugely different. Yeah. And I think that's where that 2000, 2005 era is such a vastly like huge kind of, I don't want to say vacuum, but this big space of what was there before and what came after. It was almost like pre-color TV and then all of a sudden color TV and you're like, whoa, I was missing all of this stuff in the past. I mean, you can still enjoy it, but you know, it's a big difference and a big leap forward. And yeah, that was it came after, but that was a fantastic driver.
All right. Fairway Woods, sub 750 bag. I went with the Ping G10 three wood. I believe this came out in 2007, $70 with a Ping stock shaft. I think Ping usually has pretty good stock shafts. And I could use this club day to day. I also just generally hit fairway woods from this era, maybe a little bit better than modern fairway woods. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but I just feel like it's true. And I think fairway wood technology has changed in ways that haven't necessarily benefited maybe my particular delivery condition. I don't exactly know what's going on. But I just love fairway woods from this era, and I feel like I can use them almost more effectively than the new product.
The G10 was such a great fairway wood. It was really shallow. There was a G10. It was one of the first times I think Ping introduced a draw model. I thought it again shallow, very very easy to hit, and that was kind of when there was a little bit beforehand, but miraging steel started getting used. Not that it was used in that model, but a lot of carpenter steel and stronger steels were used in fairway woods. And you started to see this bigger jump in performance again, not quite to the titanium level that we're seeing now, but still a very playable driver, or sorry, very playable fairway wood. For myself, I went with the driver is synonymous with not being very forgiving. I love the fairway woods. I actually still have a number of these fairway woods kicking around. And I got like this because I went less on the driver. I actually got two of these fairway woods, and that's the TaylorMade SLDR.
Now they're, oh God.
Yeah. So
I would not be able to hit that fairway wood.
I love it. They're small. They're pretty compact. They are adjustable as well.
Now you're a high spin player, right?
I don't have great delivery. Okay. So I naturally create more spin.
I'm on the opposite side of the
spectrum.
Yeah. I can use help with spin. I think maybe that's part of why modern fairway woods don't really suit me, because a lot of them are really low spin and I can use that spin to get up in the air a little bit. But SLDR was a low spin, like bomber three wood, right?
Yeah, it's like I had it until I had a fairway wood for like a number of years, and I tried that and I said, this is it. I literally hit five golf balls with it. And I said, yep, I want to order one of these and then I'll figure out a shaft for it. And I played that for a very, very long time. I remember getting fit for a new fairway wood and I brought it in. I said, good luck with this one, guys. Like, have fun. And they beat it by a few yards and it was kind of interesting to see, but to know how good that thing was, like I talked to some of my club nerd friends and that's kind of still one of those models. Now there was a couple different versions. There was a glued hosel version, and then there was a C version, which was like a less expensive version that came out in the marketplace. So you will see these different models. The prices will vary, but I found two of the adjustable SLDR fairways, the original ones, for $90 a piece, and that kind of fit right into my budget of under that $750. And for me, like again, I own them now, so I definitely go on eBay and buy a couple more if I needed to.
Okay, cool. Pre-2005, what I went with was the Sonartech NP99 4-wood, Aldila shaft, $30.
Nice.
It wasn't in great condition, but it wasn't in terrible condition. This is sort of a classic fairway wood, and I thought of it because a few months ago, maybe, Andy from the Fried Egg, the founder of the Fried Egg, posted something about Vince India's fairway wood, which is exactly this model. Sonartech, it's from 2004. Vince India, who is a Korn Ferry Tour player, has been on the podcast, is still playing this fairway wood. And what he said about it specifically is that I appreciate having a fairway wood that if I miss it to high toe, it's not going to go miles, you know? And so I think that he too has maybe some trouble with modern fairway woods, and he's still using this one that is, you know, 18 years old now. So I figured that would be an interesting way to spend $30. I might still get it.
That's a good one. Anyone who's curious, like Sonartech has a really very interesting story in North America. If you want to dive deep on that, I have not really written anything on it, but it's a fascinating story. For me, I went with something that I consider an absolute cult classic, and that is the TaylorMade V Steel.
Oh, yeah.
You can find them with all kinds of different shafts. You can find them with steel shafts as well. They're probably one of the last ones that offered a steel shaft kind of stock. I know someone who still has a 5-wood in the bag. Like, looks really good, shaped really nicely. You know, the modern TaylorMade Fairwoods a couple of years ago, they kind of reintroduced the V-steel sole because it was a popular design attribute. And for me, I can go back to one of those V-steels. Might not be the most forgiving, but gosh, it looks good and it still performs quite well.
Yeah, V-steel was on my list too. Other candidates that I saw were the Orlemar Tri-Metal.
Yeah, good one.
That's from the late 90s. That's another kind of cult classic. And then any of the Titleist fairway woods from this era are pretty pleasing. They definitely look a lot smaller than the modern fairway woods. There is a kind of, I think, a kind of shock that you might feel if you're playing a fairway wood from the mid 2010s or later, when you look at one of these from the mid 2000s and you think, okay, that looks like a really long shaft and that looks like a small head at the end of it. But as I said before, I haven't really had much trouble playing these older models of fairway woods. And in some ways I have had some trouble with the, with, you know, kind of modern low spinning, super bombing fairway woods. And I wonder if you've noticed players having that problem in that spot in their bag.
When it comes to fairway woods, 100%, I think some people struggle off the deck, and larger fairway woods can be an issue if someone's trying to lift the ball up. You know, they're not hitting necessarily down on it. I guess that's probably not the best way to describe it, but kind of a way to visualize it.
If you're scooping a fairway wood, if you're trying to lift it, often what's going to happen is that it's going to dive left, right?
Yeah.
And there's going to be no spin on it.
Yeah. You're going to top it, or it's going to, like, you're going to hit this kind of like low running one to the left for a right-handed golfer. When Ping was developing the blueprint irons, which are their like tiny, tiny, small blade irons, Louis Oosthuizen said, like, you know, aim small, miss small. Like, those irons are some of the smallest on the market. And that was something that they kind of found through player testing, was in some cases when they were deciding on the blade size, smaller actually benefited the best players better because it offered them better turf interaction. There's less sole. And also they, you know, aim small, miss small kind of thing. So I think that does apply to fairway woods as well.
All right, let's move on to hybrid. This is another one where there are some cult classics in the category. I think fairway wood is another one of those where, you know, in this kind of era that we're talking about, from between 10 years ago and 20 years ago, there are a lot of clubs that people kind of feel nostalgic for. I think that's definitely true of the hybrids that I was looking at. So for the sub $750 bag, what I ended up finding was an Adams Super Hybrid XTD, 19 degrees, with what looked like a nice shaft in it, for $30. And I feel like that would be a pretty smooth transition from modern hybrids. It came out in 2012. I'm not sure there would be much given up there.
You can see the lineage of like a lot of the hybrids from certain companies now moving forward, because a lot of those engineers went to other companies. Chip Brewer, who works at Callaway, famously kind of made Adams what it is today. He was the CEO before he moved there. And before he was there, like, Adams was really not, like, they were small. They kind of had their niche, and all of a sudden, like, their advancement of the hybrid was driven by their design elements, and they did some ridiculously good stuff. Again, I stuck to another fair. I got a 5-wood, but my other option would be an Adams, just an Adams Idea Pro. They go for around $40 to $50. You've got to find one with like a fancy shaft, or find some newer models. You can find them for, you know, that $50, $60. One of my favorites, I still own it, is the 9031. It's probably their smallest, least forgiving hybrid. It was a white one. It had a slot on the sole and the crown. That to me was probably like my favorite hybrid. You can find those for next to nothing online. Definitely under the budget of the $90 fairway wood that I had for the 5-wood. So Adams is, when it comes to that era, it's almost impossible to beat unless you're looking for something maybe with some adjustability, but even, and then you can find some TaylorMade stuff, but Adams is really hard to beat.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I associate Adams with hybrids from this period for sure. And it's a company that, I mean, they've kind of reemerged in a different form, but it was a company that was defunct for a while, basically. And so people don't know as much about it, which means that the clubs maybe have a little bit less value on the used market, but they're still really playable, really excellent clubs. For the pre-2005 hybrid, I went with a Nikent Gen X 3DX Ironwood at 20 degrees. That's $20. So that's super cheap. But Nikent is another one of these companies that isn't active now, I don't think, right? They went kaput.
Yeah, I actually wrote a deep dive story at Golf Digger X about the death of Nikent, which was, I mean, it was a fascinating story. They offered a lot of really cool stuff. And yeah, I mean, to go with a hybrid, I literally can't not agree with the going with the Nikent, because I had one. I had a lot of stuff. If we start playing this game, I'd say I'd own most of these things at some point. But the Nikent would be the one for me, because it was the hybrid that like was everywhere. And it's still very forgiving for what it was and what it is. And yeah, hard to beat for the price.
All right, let's go to the iron sets. For the sub $750 bag, I just found a set of Ping G15 irons, 4-iron through gap wedge, for $255. Now, I don't have any particular opinions about the G15 iron specifically, but I think that Ping G irons, throughout their existence, I'm not sure when the first Ping G iron was, but I feel like they've been around since at least the turn of the century. I feel like every iteration of that iron has been really playable for a huge range of players. I'm not normally somebody who would use a super game improvement iron, but the Ping G irons appear to me to be perfectly playable, very forgiving. I've played with Ping G5 irons before. Those are from 2005, and I love those. And I feel like, you know, there's just a certain magic to them where you wouldn't be surprised to see them in a 25 handicaps bag, and you wouldn't be surprised to see them in a 5 or lower handicaps bag. There's something about what they do with that kind of club.
Yeah, they've done a really good job with the G series. I think the G2 was the first one around that 2002 mark, and then the G5 came out. KJ Choi used G15s, I'm pretty sure, because he's a very shallow player, needed spin, needed something to get up in the air. So that was one that, again, that's a tour player. that's a great set of irons. For myself, I did find a number of irons in the $200 and $250 price point. One trick, and you mentioned it with Nikent and kind of with the Sonartech earlier, look for brands that either don't exist or might be kind of under the radar as far as equipment is concerned. I went with a set of Nike Pro Combos.
Oh yeah.
The original ones, or the next gen. If you get into the VR stuff, it gets a little bit more expensive still. But if you can find a set of those original, and there's a lot of them out there, around $200 Nike Pro Combos, Forge set, combo set, lovely. Hard to say.
Yeah, those are really cool looking.
And they don't have any badges, so they don't really wear too poorly like some other stuff you might find. And for me, that was really hard to beat. I found those and they were right around $200. I try and stick to budget, because like the driver and fairways and irons, you can kind of pick and choose. For me, like, you know, there's a lot of irons in that player's cavity around that sub $200 or $250 price point. So that's what I went with that, because for me, the wedges offered a couple different options, and same with the putter. So,
yeah. All right. Pre-2005 for irons, I went with TaylorMade Rack LT irons. That's good. 3 through pitching wedge. And, you know, I feel like these kind of Rack LT iron, there were a few different versions of the Rack irons, right? And the Rack LT, it seems to me, kind of occupied a category that's become a lot more popular recently, which is the cavity back iron that is aimed at players who strike the ball pretty consistently. So the so-called player's distance iron. And I think that the Rack LT was sort of an example of that. Am I right?
Yeah, they were a player's cavity back. The cast, so the cost was a little lower. They had the tuning cartridge. The rack was like resident something frequency, whatever, cartridge in the back of the golf club. There's two versions. If you look at the LT, there's a badge on the back, like right in the back of the cavity. There's actually like almost like a little stickered badge. That's second gen. First gen had the cartridge still, but the LT was written on the hosel. Those are the more sought after ones. Both are great golf clubs.
I found them for $215. I would imagine that they're not the sought after version if it's $215 for 3 through pitching wedge, but they look pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, then even sought after, that's probably kind of the price point they fit in nowadays if you look at those irons. But they were great. Really, really good set of irons. But for me, again, I had a couple options here. The one I'm going to go with, just because, and this is, as I mentioned earlier, when it comes to lie angle, this is very easy to find out because Ping has their color code chart, was the i3 blades, the original ones. I found a set for roughly $150.
Oh, wow.
That was an aspirate. Like, they kind of fluctuated a little bit. That was on the higher point of like what I wanted to go with for the irons, you know, checking with our budget. But you could definitely find them for $150. There were sets that were more money, but a Florida pitching wedge set offered that price point, and Ping irons, especially that era, were almost bulletproof. So it's nice to be able to find those and have them in pretty good shape. So that's what I went with. And again, Lyangle, you can see the color code on them, very easy to identify. So for a lot of people, when you are buying used, Ping are very popular for irons because it's easy to identify. You know, I got fit for this Lyangle. It's easy to go, and if you're looking at the used market, to find something in that same Lyangle.
So wedges, I did an interesting thing with the wedges in that for the sub $750 set, I decided to just get the newest wedges possible because, you know, I don't like the idea of buying a set of wedges that has, where the grooves have worn down and where it just looks like they're not crisp anymore. And so what I actually found was two wedges, a 54 and a 60, Mizuno MPT5 wedges, and they're in mint condition for $70 a piece. And so I just devoted a little more of my budget to getting those wedges. But my thought with the wedges is that you just want to get a kind of nice, crisp pair of wedges, and you don't want to go super bargain basement on these, in my opinion.
I agree. I think wedge spin is important when you're playing for a lot of different reasons. And so getting as new as possible or in best shape as possible. The nice thing is wedges is a lot of times it's easy to find things in pretty good shape because it's, in most cases, it's not a sexy golf club. No one's bragging about the distance they got. It's like, oh, you wouldn't believe I hit 9,000 spin on my sand wedge when I hit a full one from 50 yards. No one's really bragging about that. So there's a lot of good value when it comes to finding wedges like the T5. So I have two options here, and I want to make sure I say them both. The first would be Nike Engage wedges, mm-hmm. ones that I really liked. I have a set of them. But the one that I think people need to keep in mind, maybe not all the OEMs are going to like that I say this either way, if they even bother listening to this. But when it comes to new product, I actually went with new wedges as well. I own a set of these. I work in the golf industry. I purchased a set of these, my own cash money, is a set of Kirkland wedges. So you get a gap wedge, a sand wedge, a lob wedge. In Canada, I believe they are $159. So I think in the United States, they're $129. So $129 for a gap wedge, sand wedge, lob wedge, wide sole, forgiving golf club, standard true temper wedge shaft, a velvet grip, brand new grooves on these things. If you're not particular about wedge grinds, which I don't think a lot of people might be if they're, you know, they're trying to get into it, you literally can't go wrong with these things. It's pretty ridiculous. So that's why I went a little off menu on this. So, you know, pick up a jar of mayo and a hot dog while you're at it. You'll probably still be under your budget. And I'd say some Kirkland wedges for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that approach. I think that, you know, just trying to find the best deal possible on wedges is probably not the way to go, which means that searching for pre-2005 wedges is sometimes an exercise in futility because you're not going to necessarily find the nicest stuff. But what I ended up finding was a pair of Cleveland CG10 wedges, 52 and 58, and that was for $54 total. And this is just kind of a, you know, if you try to envision a Cleveland wedge, then that's basically what this is. This was really when kind of specialty wedges were becoming a big deal, right? That was another thing that happened in the early 2000s, where this market for specialty wedges, and I think I associate Cleveland most with this category in that period. That's when that whole thing was sort of emerging, right?
Yeah, there was like the Vokey 200s around the same time period, which were very popular. 588s had started to get into different finishes and different grinds. I, much like yourself, when it comes to the value under like pre-2005, I went with two Cleveland 588 RTGs, like just the raw wedges.
Yeah.
The raw wedges, they don't look like they're with chrome wedges or other finish wedges. They might look more worn out, but they're actually not. If you're looking for something that is might be a little rusty, but actually is probably in pretty good shape, raw wedges are the way to go. So the RTG 588s are a classic wedge. They made them for, much to your point, as we talked earlier, they had those in line for a very, very long time. We're talking probably close to a decade. And if you're looking for value, you're looking for a classic shaped wedge pre-2005, that's going to be my go-to every day of the week.
All right, putter category. I went cheap here because, you know, I think putter is extremely subjective. You might find one from 1967 that works the best for you. There are a lot of options today for new putters, And I think that that's maybe the main difference between today and back then. But you just never know what you're going to get along with. Putting is so much about feeling, about mood, and just about confidence. And so for the sub $750 set, I just found a Cleveland Classic One putter, which is an answer style putter from 2009. And it was $55 in really nice condition. And I feel like I could take that out to the course and be successful with it.
That was a great putter line. Cleveland has always offered really good value in their line of putters, in the Classic line even now.
So what did you go with for the sub $750 set putter?
This was one that I always really liked. It's a brand that is very familiar with a lot of people, and it's the Odyssey White Hot Tour. So the White Hot Tour is very specific. It was around, I want to say 2008, 2009. Might be off by a couple of years.
Was it kind of like darker colored, like yellow, maybe yellow writing on it or something like that?
Yeah, bingo. You nailed it. So it was a darker finish, because that was a thing that they were doing with the tour players the year before. So they brought that tour look to it. So it was like a flamed finish to make the metal darker. The insert was a little firmer, and they started to get into these heavier headweights. Not crazy heavy like we see now, but a lot of different head shapes. I just found, I think it was a number one, so like an answer style. But this was something where I got this for like $60 in very good shape. So it was, I think I was well under my budget when it came to everything. And again, if people are looking at this kind of category, there's a number of options within those models, within that specific brand, that are easy to kind of locate and track down.
All right. So you were well under your budget for the $750 set. I think I was literally right at $750, but once we finish talking, I need to go back and actually add it all up again. I probably should have done that before we started talking, but so it goes. For the pre-2005 putter, you know, I was just sort of casting about randomly. I didn't really know where to go with this one because I don't know about many putters from the early 2000s, really. I mean, obviously you can just go get an old answer or something like that, and it'll probably be just fine, or a Ping Xing putter. That would probably be just fine if you have a sort of arcing stroke and you like that look of putter. But I thought the TaylorMade Rasa line was pretty interesting, and the Monza in particular. It's a mallet, and you can see kind of how TaylorMade sort of gradually developed from the Monza, which was this mallet that had a few kind of weights back in it, to what's now the Spider, which is a very popular putter all over the world and on tour even, where there's this kind of extreme, you know, sort of putting the weight back as far as possible in order to increase the stability of the club. But this was kind of one of the first sort of attempts to do that. And you can see how it evolved from this Monza putter to what we now know as the Spider.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that was something where they were working with some new inserts at the time and trying some different things. And I thought that was a really, that cagey look at the time was like, you know, very unusual looking, but now we're kind of used to almost putters looking like anything at this point, anything that helps it get in the hole. Me, I'm a classic guy. I like something that is very more traditional, more blade style. And I actually kind of, we'll call it split the difference between what you mentioned, which was the Xing and the answer. I went with a My Day. So the My Day is a Xing head, which has the like curved back to it with the plumber's answer neck. A lot of people are familiar with that style. It is called the My Day. A lot of people are more familiar with it as being known as like the one that Brad Faxon used, the Titleist style. So he went from a My Day to a custom made Scotty Cameron and used that putter for a very long period of time. And that's one that I've always liked. And you know, I wanted to go a little off menu from the answer, because you could find a million answers online for under $40. Yeah. And I found my Xing bronze. I got a bronze one. One of the like manganese.
The My Day, you mean?
Yes, the My Days. So I went with the manganese bronze My Day, $40. Hard to beat.
I mean, the Ping putters are, they figured it out with the answer, you know, like decades ago, and people are still using that model of putter very, very effectively. That's why the putter category is so interesting, is that certain ideas are really, really durable.
The Mons idea was crazy at the time, and now we see these big Spider models. The answer at the time, people were calling them crazy. And
they thought they were ugly.
They thought it was just the most ridiculous thing. No one's ever going to use it. And it became the most iconic putter ever made.
It's funny how in the late 60s, tour players thought of the answer as being really ugly. And now we think of the answer as being a blade putter.
I can remember when the two ball came out and everyone goes, that is the ugliest, weirdest, craziest looking thing I've ever seen. It was the number one selling putter, one of, I think, individual model, like almost ever. I know the answer obviously goes back for a long period of time, but that style basically opened up an entire new market for putter shapes.
Yeah, two ball came out first in maybe 2001.
It was because I think Annika Sorenstam used one when she shot 59. It took a little longer to get into the pros bags because everyone thought it was like more of a game improvement putter, but it was everywhere, absolutely everywhere.
To tie this back to the theme of all the stuff that happened in the early part of this century in the equipment business, the early 2000s is really when you started to see these new mallet shapes coming onto the market, and you started to see tastes shifting about it, people starting to accept that this could be a putter. And it happened pretty quickly because, you know, 2004, the Ping, it's called a crazy, just a psycho looking putter, as weird as anything that is on the market today. And that was out there being bought and used. And so I think that in that period, in that first part of the decade, things just shifted really quickly in the putter category, just as they were shifting in the driver category and elsewhere in the equipment business. And it really set up what we see today.
I think because the equipment industry was booming so much back then, you know, designers were willing to take a chance because the cycles were a little slower, or sorry, quicker, pardon me. And because of that, I was like, let's try these bigger putters. And, you know, the crazy, for example, made Webb Simpson and Kenny Perry a lot of money. And same with drivers, right? A lot of people pre-2000 were like, I'm never using one of those big, kind of tie it in, right? Like, I'm never going to use that. It's too big. And nowadays, very few people are using a driver under maybe 450, but no one's calling it a toaster on the stick anymore. It's just a driver. Just the same way as a putter is like, oh, it's just a mallet putter. It's not a crazy looking weird thing. It's just a mallet putter designed to help you, you know, hopefully sink a few more putts or line up better at least.
All right, Ryan, where can people find you on social media?
So I'm on Instagram and Twitter, RDS Brath. It's just me, some golf clubs, and sometimes some pizza. And then I also host a podcast with Mike Marty Savage over at TXG. You can find us on the TXG podcast channel. We host The Build Shop. So it's a weekly show where we break down equipment, kind of nerd out on stuff like this. We talk about old school stuff, stuff we used to use. Mike and I are about 10 years apart from each other. So our idea of classic equipment's a little different. But we talk about fitting with the goal to educate. I mean, just like you guys do, and you do a fantastic job. I've learned so much as far as the idea of golf course architecture and what it actually means and what it represents. That we're here to educate and hopefully make people smarter about their decisions, because golf can be an expensive sport and we want people to get the best value they possibly can. And a lot of times that just means being educated and being knowledgeable.
Thanks so much, Ryan. Thank you for listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. Just to give you some closure, my $750 bag came to exactly $750, and my pre-2005 bag was $399, just under the $400 cutoff. Ryan's sets were well under both of those marks. He's clearly better at this than I am. But just so you can visualize all this stuff a bit better, I'm going to make a post for this episode on thefriedegg.com with pictures of the clubs that we chose and all that stuff. This post should be up by the day after this episode comes out. So if you're an early listener, it might not be up yet, but it will be soon. All right. Cheers.